Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. When the phenomenal violinist Rachel Barton Pine was in Little Rock last season, guest of the Chamber Music Society of Little Rock, she met with members of the Arkansas Symphony, and specifically the youth orchestra conductor Jeff Robson, to set a date for her to return and work with the young musicians in the youth orchestra in a three-day rock camp. This has now been arranged for this coming weekend. An intense experience expanding far beyond what one's mind might conjure up. It embraces genres of music Rachel has explored in her search for new ways to open up the vast scale of music as a force to teach and grow, from early music through classic, rock, and heavy metal, and beyond. Rachel and Jeff Robson are my guests to guide us, and I had the temerity to ask her how many such she conducts each year.
Well, now, as far as teaching camps, I have been on the faculty of Mark O'Connor's various fiddle camps since the late 90s, and I'll be going back to his current incarnation of his multi-genre camp in Boston at the beginning of June, so really looking forward to that. It's an amazing place where you get exposure to a whole variety of styles, from klezmer violin to Celtic violin to bluegrass to jazz to classical, and, you know, not only do the students get to learn from masters in each of these different genres, but the teachers get a wonderful chance to interact with and learn from each other, you know, where normally our worlds don't necessarily intersect. Then there are two other camps that I teach at each summer, the Mark Wood Rock Orchestra Camp, which is now celebrating its fifth anniversary year, and that's a very specifically rock-oriented place for violinists, violists, cellists, and bass players, in other words, bowed-stringed instruments, to go and learn how to rock out. So we have classes in improvising, songwriting, arranging, how to make a rock-type sound on your unplugged acoustic instrument, and then if you are using an electric instrument, we have classes in how to use all of your pedals and effects, and there's chamber groups, orchestra, workshops, all kinds of fun stuff. And I also, every August, go up to the mountains of North Carolina and teach at a Scottish fiddle camp, because that's one of my other loves, is the specifically 18th century Scottish folk music.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, lots of good variety. And, of course, in between all of that, I make the usual rounds of the classical festivals. Well, that's the fun of it. Different city or country every week, all year long.
Now, did you have anything like this in your basic early training? Was Mark O'Connor the one that caught your affection and your imagination to go on with it in your own style?
I would say the answer is neither. Now, as a young person, I certainly listened to a whole variety of different types of music, and particularly loved rock, but also enjoyed hearing different kinds of folk or traditional music, different kinds of popular music, just all kinds of interesting stuff. Chicago blues I grew up with, and then exploring the wide range of classical, from contemporary music back through the, you know, Romantic era, the Baroque era, and even earlier music than that. So there's just so much good music, and I couldn't get enough of it. But it never occurred to me to play any non-classical styles on my own instrument until I was around 20 years old, and I started looking for creative ways to engage new listeners through outreach opportunities. And so I started going on rock radio stations and, you know, connect to my fellow rock fans and tell them how exciting and intense classical was, and that you don't have to choose between rock and classical, but you can like them both just like I do. And it's always been so rewarding to have, you know, a fellow fan of the same bands that I like come up to me after a symphony concert and say, wow, this is my first time going to an actual orchestra show, and I just loved it. So that was very motivating, and Mark O'Connor had actually heard about me doing this and realized that I was a kindred spirit, so that's why he invited me to join his faculty. And then, of course, I started learning about a lot of the fiddle traditions that I hadn't been exposed to yet, bands, which has been such a great honor. And, oh, for example, you know, the drummer of Slayer, a couple years ago, I was hanging out with him backstage, and he pulled out his iPod, and it was filled with Berlioz, Rachmaninoff, and Liszt. And so now I can say to my fellow Slayer fans, hey, guys, check out those composers. You know, it's those kind of stories that I try to spread, and you know, it's definitely fun to play this other music on my instrument. And in fact, interestingly enough, I've now started to sort of do the opposite. Instead of just looking for the classical roots of heavy metal, I realized that heavy metal has existed for, you know, 40 years now in the world, and it's, you know, a very developed type of musical language. And just as Bartok used Hungarian folk music in his violin concerto, or Dvorak used the influence of the rhythms, harmonies, and melodies of Czechoslovakian folk music in his violin concerto, I realized, well, why shouldn't there be a violin concerto with heavy metal as its inspiration, as its musical roots? And so I'm working with a particular composer on a violin concerto, but I've already commissioned a number of my friends, either violinists or composers from the classical realm who also love the type of rock music that I do, to write concert pieces that are classical music but inspired by rock and metal, in the same way that all of these composers for so many years, you know, Debussy using inspiration from jazz, or even Bach, you know, writing pieces based on the minuet. There's always this cross-pollination between, you know, the popular or folk music of the time and place of the classical composers and the art music that they create.
Yeah. Now, Jeff, have you already started exploring these sort of interest, and your students, your orchestra members, were already playing with this type of investigation?
Something I talk about, not just with the youth orchestra students, but to, you know, fellow musicians all the time, is I think the palette of different sounds that an orchestra can produce is so perfectly suited to creating all sorts of different types of music. So to sort of pick up maybe on what Rachel was just saying about maybe some of these new pieces her composer friends are working on, is that, you know, I'm certain and confident that they'll find that the orchestra can produce so many sounds that are so similar to, you know, what a 3 or 4 piece band that's electric and all plugged in and with lots of effects would be trying to produce. I think a full symphony orchestra has a huge range of possibility to do all sorts of different styles.
The orchestra is, you know, the greatest palette there is.
Absolutely.
And to be able to paint with that palette, with the aesthetic of this great rock music, I think is bringing the best of two worlds together to create something that's greater than the sum of its parts. And I also think it's important for kids who are learning instruments to not just get exposed to this amazing music of the past, but also to connect what they're doing with the present. And, you know, that you don't have to choose between, you know, playing rock music with a garage band with your friends on guitar and playing your violin and doing some Mozart in your school orchestra. But in fact, you can play that rock stuff on your violin and learn Mozart and enjoy all of it, and it's all equally cool.
Absolutely, and I think students now, I mean, music, especially popular music, is so fragmented, and there are so many different genres that I think really it's almost come full circle that, you know, in that to students, music is music, and so I think it's easy for students to draw the sort of connections that we're trying to highlight with a program like this. And also, I think that, you know, a background in classic rock is something that a lot of, you know, unless these kids are in a band and kind of in the that sort of scene at school, there's not, I feel like a lot of what we're doing is rock and roll education as well, because it's not necessarily music that high school students and younger now are growing up listening to, like, you know, like we did.
That's so true, and sadly, a lot of modern pop music, I don't want to be one of those people that, you know, bemoans the good old days, but I don't think anybody disagrees that a lot of pop music is becoming more simplistic these days, and that could be really directly attributable to less music education in the schools, because a lot of the great popular music artists of the last generation, you know, had basic music training, and a lot of times it was through their public schools.
Definitely.
So they just sort of naturally were exposed to, you know, certain concepts of theory and complexity of music, and now, gosh, you have a lot of things where it's one chord, and, you know.
And also, you know, instruments were put in kids' hands in 7th and 8th grade, even if it was a guitar in a garage, literally, you know, and as opposed to now, kids have laptops to work with, and I think pop music reflects that, certainly.
But when you are working with the students now and playing to these audiences and working with the young composers coming in with their ideas, you think that there's a greater excitement now in all those groups to explore the possibilities with more and more of the crossovers from one style, from one genre to another. It becomes like a cooking school where let's put this in and see what this will taste like.
Crossover is a dangerous word because there's so much cheesy stuff out there, you know, violinists doing sort of poppy things, and, you know, they might sell a lot of tickets, but is it really good art music? I think the most important thing is for each individual young person to have their creativity nurtured and to discover what it is that they want to be doing with their art, whether they become professional or not, that they, you know, that their creativity is nurtured and developed, and that they continue to have a relationship with music throughout their life, both as a music appreciator and a music creator.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more you can give them that can get them excited about it, the better. And whether that means they go on and strictly play classical or mostly play rock or invent something that we have never even imagined yet, you know, we're giving them the tools to be able to go on and do that. And I just think this orchestra in Little Rock, I just really commend them so much for their open-mindedness, and I think that they can really serve as a model for the future.
Well, the ones that are in the, or, you know, just coming into the professional business of music, graduating from schools and youth orchestras from one step to another, they're bringing these ideas with them. So they're much more open to playing this music on a classical program if it's mentioned to them, or even compose their own and do some improvisation if they're allowed to, or if they want to when they're practicing things together. Don't you find that, Jeff? You play with them. You are in the orchestra with them and discuss these things and get ideas to mix and mingle with your youth orchestras and with those who've just recently graduated from youth orchestras into the professional world.
Well, I think that's certainly something that you can see around the music world today. There are so many classical music artists who are taking advantage of opportunities to perform classical music in, you know, all sorts of different venues and mixing styles, you know, and again, I agree with Rachel that I think crossover is a slightly dangerous word. We're talking about creating sort of one amalgam style, but rather just mixing them so that they're, you know, side by side. And I think musicians all over the world are doing this. And certainly a lot of that is a product of being exposed to different kinds of music like we're doing to our students now, as well as, you know, just the diversification of pop music and classical music that's happened, especially over the last 40 years.
If you don't add your own voice, then you're not making music the most personal way you can, and also creating music for and reflective of our time. And so, you know, I think we're now finally starting to turn the corner where, you know, when I was a young person, there was a real fear of, oh, if you let somebody play, you know, in a non-classical style, it might warp their classical playing. If you let somebody spend too much time improvising instead of doing their etudes, that might not be healthy. And now I think teachers are realizing that, you know, the more you can do that exercises your imagination as well as your fingers and muscles, you know, the better you're going to be at everything you do. And I find that when I'm playing a standard repertoire piece, like the Mendelssohn or Tchaikovsky concerto, you know, I have more insights into how I might want to phrase it. You know, it's totally within the language of those pieces. I'm not adding, you know, distortion or pick slides or making any rock effects. Mm. But just the ideas that come flooding into my head, you know, are, I think, you know, more plentiful because of the fact that I've been doing some composing or doing some arranging or improvising. And, you know, I think it positively impacts, you know, what people do, even within strictly classical music, if they're able to go and do a little fiddling on the side or just any of these other things, and which is actually historically valid.
And as you said, when you went into this field with your instrument deliberately to see how your instrument responded to this new approach, that's what all the instruments have done. And if the instruments can do, the piano can do it, the saxophone has crossed over from jazz and popular music into classical music all the time. And so many of these instruments are speaking to you from their origins, which go back thousands of years.
Yeah, and I think that really highlights that this divide between art music and pop music is really a very artificial thing. And I think certainly in, you know, for myself growing up, and I think from what Rachel has said, probably, you know, quite similarly for her, being taught as classical musicians, well, you know, you're playing classical music, you know, you're not doing this other stuff. And just as you point out with the fact that already many instruments play multiple styles of music, all we're really talking about are musical styles.
I love the fact that our program is interspersing,
yeah,
you know, a rock piece and then a classical piece and then a rock piece and then a classical piece. And my hope is that, you know, by the end of the set list, as we call it, that people won't really care what's, you know, called one and what's called another. It's just, okay, one exciting piece after the next.
Exactly.
Jeff and I worked very closely to choose the repertoire, and so all of the rehearsal preparation will be towards getting those particular pieces ready for the concert. But certainly, as we're working with the kids on those pieces, you know, we hope that we'll be instilling lessons that will, you know, go beyond and positively impact, you know, the next pieces that they learn after I'm long gone.
Violinist Rachel Barton Pine and Arkansas Symphony Orchestra Youth Orchestra conductor Jeff Robson. The three-day rock camp opens this Friday, 9 to 5 each day, culminating in a concert featuring the young musicians of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra Youth Orchestra and music from Sibelius, Bruch, and Paganini, also Van Halen, Metallica, and Led Zeppelin. Jeff Robson on the podium and Rachel Barton Pine violin soloist. Sunday, March the 30th from 3 to 4:30 p.m. at Wildwood Park for the Arts. For tickets, call 501-666-1761 or visit www.arkansasymphony.org.
Here's a look at what's happening in the arts in Arkansas. Today at the Arkansas Rep, Les Miserables is on stage with shows at 2 and 7. Performances continue Wednesdays through Sundays through April 6th. At the Arkansas Art Center's Children's Theater, you can see The Boy Who Cried Wolf today at 2 p.m. Plus, there are special matinee performances this week during spring break, Tuesday through Friday at 2 p.m. In Searcy this week, Harding University presents Radium Girls Thursday through Saturday at 7 p.m. in the O'Ray Performing Arts Center. Saturday in Stuttgart, the Houston Ballet presents Sleeping Beauty Act 3 at Phillips Community College's Grand Prairie Center, 8 p.m. Opening April 1st at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville, Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Wizard of Oz. And April 6th at UALR, Artsbury presents saxophonist Steve Owen. On display around Little Rock at the Arkansas Arts Center, The Crossroads of Memory, Carol Clore and the American South, and an exhibition of works by the Arts Center's woodworking instructors. At the Clinton Presidential Center, Spies, Traitors, and Saboteurs, Fear and Freedom in America. And at Historic Arkansas Museum, the Mid-Southern Watercolorist 44th Annual Juried Exhibition, and Sierra Long, A Different Perspective. And that's a look at the arts calendar for this week. For more on what's going on in Arkansas, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org.
The very thought of you.
Published first in 1997, Mitch Albom's Tuesdays with Maury was an instant bestseller and has gone on to be published in more than 31 languages in 36 countries. Its extraordinary appeal earning countless encomia. Readers reacting to the simplicity of the story of a friendship founded in 1974 between a professor with one of his many students. An enduring love where, by chance, they meet again some 20 years later, just in time to catch the thread of life left to the professor, Maury Schwartz, dying from Lou Gehrig's disease. With Mitch Albom, now a very successful sports writer, life's lessons underscored in this memoir, rewritten as a play by Jeffrey Hatcher and Mitch Albom, being staged by Weekend Theatre. Arkansas actors Alan Douglas and Case Dillard, neither of whom has read the book, who joined me a few days ago, give their reactions to the story. Case Dillard.
I think the draw of this show in particular is that I'm looking for an answer. It's whether I'm seeking a solution answer in dance or in music or in art, I'm sort of seeking a solution. And I go back to my old professor. I'm not looking in the past. I'm building a new relationship, a new dynamic with him. I quit the piano. I quit became a sports writer. And now I have an opportunity to reconnect with this human being who was my teacher to solve the mysteries of life in the last moments so I can face myself.
Darren, you mentioned the Ted Koppel interview.
Yes.
Is that brought into the play, into the book by the playwright?
Yes. So there's, in fact, that is, I believe, how they meet. Mitch sees them on the television at Cisco.
Yeah.
And so we do some revisiting of those interviews.
And there's so many flashbacks, memories. How does the play handle those?
Well, generally, all the flashbacks happen at the beginning of the play. Mm-hmm. And because it's kind of the piece of wisdom in the watching the play process is that to see Maury as someone who is lively, who lives in his body and is happy in his body, slowly kind of lose touch with it. So all of those kind of happen early on so you can see what you're losing.
Yes, because they knew each other for the length of time that a college career exists.
Yeah.
And said goodbye with a hug and affection, obviously.
Right. And a promise to keep in touch.
Mm. Of course, we all do that. Yeah. And
I was going to say, there is a third character that we've sort of established in the show. Maury loved the fact that Mitch had a relationship with music and the piano. And then during auditions, and some people, if the actor playing Mitch can play the piano, they play the piano. And during auditions, there was a piano sitting there, and we've added that as a character in the show.
Now, does that come in at the beginning when you're working
to
introduction?
It's in the middle, I close it, I push it away, it's gone, and then I bring it back at the end, and that's another relationship.
Mitch's path led him so far away. If he'd stayed with piano, maybe he would have had a closer or more recent or a more ongoing connection with his professor. But who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
It just so happened he took a path that took him further away from the world in which his professor lived. And therefore, it was a greater shock to realize when he heard, it was the Ted Koppel interview that he saw on television, wasn't
yes, it? Yes, it was at that point.
That this man he'd admired so much was so close to being gone.
Yeah.
And what short time was left to seize it.
So, yeah, who gets messages like that, right?
I know, and able to act upon it.
Well, absolutely.
And build on it.
I think it's interesting, actually, if we're going to add more Ted Koppel, that was believed when he signed off being the host of Nightline. He was quoting Maury at the very end, which was interesting to see someone kind of still connected to an interview that old. But what's been nice about this, the two things that kind of it does really well. One is because doing it in a play form, you know, it happens right there. You get to take part in the conversation. And those are always wonderful plays to do. And the other thing it does is you realize it's part of this other tradition that we all really love, the one about teachers and students, about education. I mean, things like Corn is Green and The Miracle Worker and that kind of stuff. You get to see, at least be in the presence of that feeling of learning. Doing it's how he's living or the fact that he is still teaching.
What about you, Case?
I would say that it's our job to honor the script. And so if I end up reading the book and there are pieces of that I can bring to the script, then good. But we're doing the script, not the book.
It's there. It's almost written as a play in terms of the development of the relationship again, but of the passage of time.
Huh.
And you have the earlier days, you say, that comes at the beginning, where it establishes why they know each other and what they felt about each other, because Mitch, obviously did know deep down that Maury, his professor, was very fond of him and respected his abilities. And so that goes into the mix of the development as well, that Mitch realizes that he hasn't fulfilled the potential that Maury saw in him, because he's taken his very pragmatic approach to work on something that he knows he can do, he can write, and he pursues it. And all of a sudden, he's brought up short. And when you get to that part in the play, case, what sort of connections do you make so that the audience realizes quite the depth of the shock that you have felt?
I think when he finally sees Maury, you know, on the TV, I don't know, but he sees a missed potential. He sees his own potential. Like, he not only sees what relationship he could have had with Maury over the last 16 years, he sees what he missed in himself over the last 9 to 16 years. He could have had a great dynamic with his professor, and he could have become this human being, but he became uber-focused on becoming a sports journalist, and he missed out on his own potential over the last 9 to 16 years. And so he goes, wait a second, I missed out on a lot. It's going to catch up.
The little other snippet, and presumably it's in the book as well, about that Maury actually taught at Brandeis, which is a very kind of open school, open-minded school, and he taught people like Abby Hoffman and Angela Davis. And I'm thinking, all right, what's that connection? What was he, a firebrand in some sort of way? Was he saying, hey, go against the...
Stirring the pot.
Well, yeah, was he? I mean, and you don't really quite get a sense of that because this is a more kind of ambered sort of memory. Yeah. But, well, I don't know. It's hard to know whether he was just interested in what he was saying, but there is a sense of, there's a conviviality to him, you know.
But also the sort of personality from the descriptions in the book that didn't care what other people thought of what he was doing physically or what he was saying or how he was addressing a particular subject or the class as a whole.
Yeah.
Because he was comfortable in himself. He knew what he knew and that it wasn't complete, so he explored it. And that's the type of teacher that I think we all respond to.
Oh, absolutely.
Whatever the subject, you know.
Yeah.
And given that opportunity to work these two very different personalities, one still in the prime of life, one very, very close to leaving it altogether, and to bear that in mind while you're acting, while you're putting your thoughts and emotions into these two different characters. Yes, what appeals to you that can embrace more than you had realized until you started exploring it?
Yeah, right. And to give him his due, by the way, I should mention, because the director keeps banging me over the head with this particular fact, which is that the writing of the book was actually based on trying to get money to pay for Maury's medical bills. And, I mean, the assumption that it was going to be, you know, on the bestseller list 2 years was not, of course, it may have been in the back of his mind, but maybe not. Yeah. So. Whatever reasons that Mitch was doing it, Maury would certainly love the fact that people are still listening to him.
Alan Douglas and Case Dillard, the two cast members in the show Tuesday with Maury, which opens in Weekend Theatre April the 4th, running through April the 19th, with a Sunday matinee at 2:30 April the 13th. For tickets, visit weekendtheatre.org. Also, at UALR, the last 2 days of the American College Dance Festival Association Conference, with public performances tonight and tomorrow, which is the gala, closing performance, 7 p.m. in the UALR University Theatre. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.